But let me begin by saying welcome and thank you for joining us. This is the second teleconference on this subject. My name, for those of you who don't know, is Chris Lucas, and I'm one of the technical assistance specialists for AOA's ADDGS National Resource Center. And with me today is Robert Stemmler from the Resource Center, Diane Bronstein, who is the Director of Technical Assistance for the Resource Center, and also on the phone is Lori Stahlbaum, who most of you know. She is the AOA Project Officer for the Grants Program, and I believe as a guest, I don't think he has speaking privileges like most of the grantees, but Josh Wiener, who works for RTI International, is most likely listening in. So Josh, welcome if you're on. Let me go over what we're going over today for those of you who don't have an agenda. As I said, we're recording the call. We'll have presentations for all of you by Lori, and Lori will be discussing important features and key highlights about the grant announcement, as well as key proposal, just important features and key highlights, and she'll be speaking for about 15 minutes. Diane will then come after Lori, and she'll be speaking about key proposal elements, and she'll speak for about 10 minutes. And after that, we're going to have a questions and discussion time where we will go over questions that you may have, and we'll do our best to provide answers for you. And I'll talk about that more when we get there. So, why don't we start off with Lori?
Okie dokie. Hi again, everybody. Thank you so much for joining our teleconference. For those of you who we had the question and answer last week, around the same time we post this teleconference, we will also have last week's teleconference on our website, as Chris said. So if you want to see what other people were asking, I encourage you to check that out. Anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit about the key points and highlights from the program announcement. And I think, first we'll start with just some basic information. And the first thing I think you're probably all aware of is that the deadline is May 27th. Just needed to say that out loud. And I'd really like to encourage everyone to try to submit their application electronically this year. It's not a requirement, but the Department of Health and Human Services is moving in the direction, and I don't know when that'll be, but certainly in the near future, where it will be the required filing process. So my thought is that if you try it this year when it's optional, you can kind of attempt things when there's less pressure, and if you hit glitches, you'll know what they are when the time comes and you have to do it, or you'll get through it and you'll be ahead of the game when it does become a requirement. On the AOA website, we do have a link that provides all the instructions for electronic filing. And I know some of you may have participated in AOA's teleconferences last week, and from what I've heard, those were very helpful. But I want to let everyone know that here at AOA, we have a human point of contact for anyone who is interested in filing electronically and who has any problems, issues, concerns, questions, complaints, what have you. Arthur Miller, who is one of the AOA staff who put together the teleconferences last week, is available to help anyone who is willing to try the electronic process. And, big questions, small questions, seemingly silly questions. Arthur is great. He's been working with the Alzheimer Demo Continuation Grantees, and they just can't say enough great things about him. So I want to, if you're thinking about trying electronic filing, I want to give you Arthur's contact information, and I really encourage you to call him and give it a go, and he can help you in many ways. Arthur Miller's direct number is 202-357-3438. If you choose not to file electronically, that's fine. But I do want to say, I can't require you to send your proposal via FedEx, UPS, or any of those kind of delivery services, but I would like to strongly encourage it, because here at AOA, any mail we get to the U.S. Postal Service is irradiated, which means there's usually a delay in our getting any packages, sometimes as much as 2 to 3 weeks, and when we get the papers through the irradiated mail, they're all stuck together, and you pull the pages apart like like that. And things are legible, but I just want you to know what happens to our U.S. mail. Now, if you do use the U.S. mail, so long as your proposal is postmarked by May 27th, regardless of when we receive it, it will be reviewed. So if that's the mailing choice for your state, that's okay, and you will not be excluded from review so long as you have that, have your application postmarked by May 27th. I think everyone probably knows, but I want to say it anyway, only state governmental entities are eligible to apply for the Alzheimer's program. However, partnerships are, of course, encouraged, as a matter of fact, they're almost required, aren't they? Page 6 of the program announcement states that applicants must involve community-based organizations in the planning and implementation of their project. So, the more partners you can bring to the table, I think also the stronger, time has shown us, the stronger your project will be in the long run. And the demo program does still continue to target traditionally underserved populations. So you must be sure to include disadvantaged populations as part of your target group in your program. This can be rural, this can be limited English speaking, or any of the various ethnic cultural communities that you might see as falling through the cracks in your states or communities. In terms of available funding, this year we plan to fund 7 new Alzheimer's demonstration projects, 3-year projects. The maximum funding for any project will be $325,000. This is a little less than in years past, but it's pretty close. We've usually been around $350,000 this year maximum. The maximum amount you can request is $325,000. And I want to say I'm expecting a pretty competitive competition this year. We have 24 eligible states, and just from these 2 teleconferences that we've held, we've had 17 states register to listen in and participate in the teleconferences. So I'm assuming we may get 15 to 17 applications, and we're only going to have funding for 7 grants. So one of the things I want to encourage you to do is be very clear when you write your proposals. One of the things I used to do when I was in graduate school is I would have my sister read my papers because she had no background in social work. And so it worked really well for me, and I sort of want to encourage you that if you have the time, you might want to actually see if you could get someone who's outside of your program to look through your proposal and see if it makes sense. Because when the reviewers are looking at it, they know about the program and state policies and Alzheimer's disease and et cetera, but they're going to be reading it cold, so you want to make sure it's clear so that as they're reading it, they understand your great ideas. So sometimes an outside person can give you a real objective view on where things might be a little confusing. Just a thought. The evidence-based research component of the program announcement. I want to stress that this time we're just asking you to use examples from the evidence-based research to inform your project. You do not need to replicate evidence-based research. On page 3 of the program announcement, we state that all applicants will review a new scientific finding in the formulation of their project proposals. This means that while at this time you do not need to replicate the research, it does mean you need to show in your proposal that you've reviewed some of the evidence-based research and then indicate in your proposal how that research that you reviewed relates to the formulation of your program's design. On page 1, I'm sorry, I'm referring to the announcement. I hope that's helpful, because most of what I'm talking about is straight out of the announcement with some little sidebars. On page 1 of the program announcement, we've offered our definition of evidence-based research, and that is evidence-based research is defined as controlled research that has been published in scientific journals. So so long as it fits into that criteria, you can certainly use it. on page 3 of the announcement, we did identify some possible evidence-based projects that you might find useful. And we've also provided on the website little one-page summaries. I want to stress that you're in no way required to use any of these example or sample programs. You're more than welcome to cite examples of programs, projects of your own that you think would be useful. We just offered these as a source of information and give you an idea of what we consider, further example of what we consider evidence-based research. And I hope you did find that helpful. In terms of systems change, last year AOA began requiring that Alzheimer demo grantees link their projects to other state systems change efforts. And I just want to clarify, because in years past this has been optional, but at this point this is a requirement. It is not an option. So you do need to address the systems change component of the program announcement. I want to point out two statements that are in our program announcement. I think they're both that are in H4. The one is that AOA will not fund 3-year grant applications for discrete standalone projects that are not connected to the state's overall systems change activities. So that's where the partnerships and et cetera come in. Also, I want to clarify that we state lower on page 4 that we will evaluate the proposals based on the extent of progress a state expects to make under the grant in advancing systems change, not on the current status of your state's efforts to support people with Alzheimer's disease or their family caregivers. So, for example, if your state long-term care system is still in its infancy stages, you won't be penalized in the grant review. I go over that very carefully with the grant reviewers to make sure they're clear that they're looking at the extent of progress, not the current state of progress. At the same time, if your state's long-term care system is quite advanced, you're not going to get extra points. The grant reviewers will truly look at the extent of progress expected. They're only going to look at the current state of your long-term care system and try to understand your state system and its impact from the proposal. Also, a new feature in this year's program announcement, and it's because of the required systems change component, AOA is requiring that each state will budget at least 25% of their state project director's time to their Alzheimer demo project. You need to be sure to include this in your budget justification that you provide with your proposal. The project director, I want to clarify, the project director must be a state employee or a person from the employed by the applicant agency or a person employed by the state agency as a direct contractor. What this means is that the project director cannot be from a sub-grantee organization. There's not going to be potential for any more pass-through grants. In terms of the did I miss something? Oh, well, okay, sorry, got sidetracked. In terms of the direct service component, I think I'm going out of order, sorry. There's been a change this year in the funding requirements for direct service. In the past, we required 50% of the combined federal and non-federal funds to be used for direct service. This year, only 50% of the federal funding amount needs to be allocated towards direct service. So if you request $300,000 and you match at $100,000, you'll be expected to put at least $150,000 or one half of $300,000 towards direct service. The 6 categories of direct service that come straight out of the public health service legislation that mandates this program are identified on page 9 of the program announcement, and they are home health care, personal care, adult daycare, companion services, short-term care in health facilities, and other respite. And I want to be very clear, because this comes up every year, case management does not count as a direct service. Any funds that are used to provide case management need to come out of the other pots of money, for example, the other half of the federal funds or from the state match. in terms of the match. The match for the demo program is different from the older Americans Act program requirements. American Alzheimer's demo program match increases every project year. So the first year, you must match, the state must match at 25% of the federal amount, the second year at 35%, and the third year at 45%. Here at AOA, we are aware that this can be difficult for states, but we have no control over this because it's mandated by the program's legislation. One thing I recommend states consider doing is each year decrease the amount of your federal request so that your match dollar amount remains constant, even though the percentage of match goes up. And I want to reiterate, because I think most people know this or may have asked about this, but match can be either cash or in kind, and it can be provided by partner agencies, not just the state agency. So it doesn't have to all come from the state. So you can work with your partners to try to meet the match requirements. And then in terms of the Assistant Secretary for Aging's priorities, which is stated, well, I don't know, on page 16 of the program announcement, I think there, I understand there may have been some confusion caused by the statement that says preference will be given to the states that have not previously been funded through this program. What I want to assure you is that if you're a current grantee or have been a grantee in the past, you're absolutely eligible to apply. What this statement means is that if there's a state, if a state should apply that's never been funded, which means they've probably never applied before, the Assistant Secretary for Aging does have the right to give them priority when she makes her funding decisions. This does not mean she'll give priority to anyone else. So if you have a grant ending this June, you will not, you're not going to be penalized for applying this grant cycle. And at the same time, if you've had a grant in the past and you're applying after being out of the program for a while, you won't be given priority either. This is only to those states that have never ever been funded. Those are the only states she can give priority to. And this is solely at the Assistant Secretary's discretion. And I would like to say that in my short time running this program, I've actually never seen her exercise that option. So I just don't want anyone to feel that some people may have been a little discouraged by that statement, but it's really not as onerous as it sounds. And I think that's all for me at the moment. I'll take a sip of soda.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lori. Next up is Diane Bronstein, and Diane is the Director of Technical Assistance for AOA's ADDGS National Resource Center. And after Diane speaks for a few minutes, we'll have opportunity for questions and discussion. So, Diane, go ahead.
Great. Chris, thanks so much. As it says in your agenda, I'm going to be going over key proposal elements, and basically there are three topics I'd like to discuss: bringing community partners to the table, systems change, and sustainability. So beginning with bringing community partners to the table, I just wanted to emphasize again that experience with former and ongoing demonstration projects clearly indicates that the strength of a project is closely tied to the strength of its community partnerships. Typically, community partners include area agencies on aging, Alzheimer's Association chapters, and institutions of higher education, such as community colleges or universities, to assist with project evaluation and data collection, for example. However, I want to point out that the list of community partners is nearly limitless. So, for example, some states have engaged local partners with expertise in reaching out to minority populations. Other projects have engaged their faith communities. Projects have built successful partnerships, for example, with healthcare providers, including physicians, hospitals, nursing homes, and home health agencies. Also, I would encourage everyone, don't be afraid to think outside of the box. For example, one of the first places dementia is likely to be noticed is at the bank, when someone is having difficulty managing their money. Banks, grocery stores, and utility companies might also serve as community partners. So that's just a general thought about thinking broadly. With regard to systems change, referring back to what Lori talked about before, this year's grant announcement does require grant activities to be connected to the state systems change activities. In order to fulfill this requirement, state applicants obviously need to be familiar with and become a part of their safe, enduring long-term care environment. This usually means being mindful of recommendations made by long-term care commissions, and in particular, gaining an in-depth understanding of your state's Medicaid home and community-based service program. Also, becoming familiar with the state's Family Caregiver Support Program and other programs serving people needing community-based services, such as younger people with mental retardation who can often develop dementia at an early age. Another factor which is very important to consider is where your state's Medicaid and other long-term care programs are headed. Many states are currently recipients of large, and I'm sure you're all familiar with these, systems change grants made by the U.S. Centers on Medicare and Medicaid, CMS. Other states are recipients of grants made jointly by CMS and the Administration on Aging to establish aging and disability resource centers. Some of you, of course, know, commonly referred to as ADRCs. Applicants need to be aware of these kinds of grants and need to know which grants your state may currently have or may be applying for, is another thing to think about. Information about what grants your state may have can be accessed by going to the www.hcvs.org website. Information about aging and disability resource centers, for example, can be found on AOA's and CMS's websites, and information about CMS's Care Systems Change grants can be found on the CMS website. And just to think ahead, links to some of these websites were provided in the agenda to this teleconference. Now, coming up on us very quickly, sometime within the next couple of days, they originally had a target date of April 23rd, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, is going to put out its grant announcement for the 2005 Systems Change Grants. I would say not only is it important for applicants to know and understand if the state, let's say Medicaid, mental health, or community health agency plans to apply for one of these grants, it is also important for everyone to read the grant announcement because it will contain CMS's definition of what they believe systems change means. And that grant announcement will be available on grants.gov website. And just for everybody, information, if you go to grants.gov, what you want to do is next go to the tab called Find Grant Opportunities, and then down that you'll see some links, and the links you're looking for is Search Grant Opportunities, and then you can either look by browse by category, which would be health, or browse by agency, which would be U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and also on the homepage of grants.gov, down the left side of the page, there's an opportunity to sign up for emails, and there's either also an opportunity to sign up for just emails about HHS programs. So I would encourage everybody to keep your eyes out for that. Also, thinking a little out of the box, I would say becoming a part of your state systems change environment might also involve linking up with state and federally funded community health centers, which serve underserved populations, or providing dementia care training to Homeland Security or first responders. It's just integrating your work into the whole system of providing care in your state. You might also want to consider getting a dementia assessment tool, for example, included in the state's Medicaid or family caregiver programs. Last but not least, I just wanted to talk for a few minutes about sustainability. One of the best ways to ensure that your project really becomes part of the state long-term care environment is to ensure its sustainability. And that's another reason why connecting with statewide system change activities is so very important. Recently, a project director told me that she took a copy of the systems change requirement over to a colleague of the Medicaid agency and told them that in order order to receive the demo grant, they had to be a part of the state systems change activities. This resulted in a significant influx of dollars in that particular state for services to people with dementias and their caregivers. So just something to think about. The most important question to consider when thinking about sustainability is, after the grant period ends, how can we ensure that the grant's activities continue? So, in addition to working with other state agencies, applicants may want to consider what parts of the grant's activities community partners might be able to carry on independently. Another way to ensure sustainability is to involve locally based philanthropic organizations as community partners from the start. In almost every state, there are large and small state-based philanthropies with a strong preference for spending dollars in their local areas. For example, you might want to invite representatives from local or state-based philanthropic organizations to become a partner early on in the process. For example, at the beginning of the grant period, you may want to ask them to pay for something small, like minor printing costs or paper plates at a meeting with community partners. The point being, to involve your potential philanthropic partner in the grant's activities from the start, so that they are familiar with the project should you need to solicit additional funding at a later time. Also, I would mention that when publicly funded hospitals get bought up by large healthcare systems, the healthcare systems are also required to set up a foundation to provide support to the local community, since tax dollars originally funded the community hospital. These kind of foundations are generally known as conversion foundations. So I would just say that those are just some of my initial thoughts on community partnerships and systems change and sustainability. And Chris, I turn it back to you. Thank you.
Okay. This next and last section here is an opportunity for everybody to ask the questions that they've got. I'd like to just mention, you know, this call is meant for those applicant agencies and the state grantees, or future state grantees, so would respectfully like to make sure that only state grantees or only state office officials are asking the questions. There are some partner people on the phone, partners who might be on the phone who might have the wrong passcode, so I just want to, you know, politely ask those people to leave their questions for another time, or email me or Diane or Lori where appropriate, and we will get to that. If you can keep your questions at just a minute or two, and we're going to try and do about 2 to 5 minutes per question. And please identify yourself, your name and where you're from, when you speak. Ahead of time, we had asked people to please email in any questions in the beginning to see if there were any popular questions that we could address at the beginning of this section. And we had two that sort of came up, and the first one would be for Lori. And I'll try and phrase this as best I can. But Lori, does reaching out to underserved populations mean that states have to reach out to new minority populations that they have never served before, or does it mean states can reach out to increasing numbers of underserved people of all kinds?
It could be either. If your state is already serving a specific, you have a large African American or Hispanic or Haitian communities in your state, dispersed throughout the state, and you've been targeting those communities in a small area, and you want to expand your reach beyond where you're working now, you could certainly propose that with your grant application and continue to work, but it would need to be more than what you're doing now, not just we want to do the same thing. So if maybe you have a program that's running in 3 counties that you want to try to reach into maybe African Americans that live in this particularly rural county, that would certainly be fine. And what was the other half of the question?
Well, I'll repeat it again just to make sure everything. Does reaching out to underserved populations mean that states have to reach out to new minority populations they've never served before, or does it mean states can reach out to increasing numbers of underserved people of all kinds?
Oh, okay. And or if you want to increase numbers, or if you want to target an entirely new population, perhaps you have a very strong program already reaching into your Hispanic communities, but you feel that there are gaps in services in the African American community, then by all means, either way, I guess the answer would be both or either.
Okay. The next question that, you know, we have a few on was asking, how does the new systems change requirement fit with the grant's historic emphasis on innovation? And I think that's more of a Diane question, so why don't you handle that one, Diane?
Well, I would just say briefly that the two are not mutually exclusionary. In fact, using the grant funding, I believe, to reach out to people with Alzheimer's disease and their families in an innovative manner could set a precedent for reaching out to people in need of home and community-based services of all kinds. So what supports people with dementias usually also assists all kinds of people needing home and community-based services and their caregivers. So it should work well together.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Excuse me, Chris?
Yes, Lori.
Lori, I just wanted to say, because she wasn't here before, Linda McFarland is here with me, and she is the grant specialist for the Alzheimer's program. So if anyone has not only questions about the program announcement or, you know, elements of, for example, that might go towards Diane, we also have Linda here today. If there are any questions about some of the grant requirements, those kind of, whatever those are, components.
Okay. Well, welcome, Linda.
Hi.
So I'd like to open up the floor to everybody out there. Feel free to speak up, and we will try to get to everybody's question. I'll let you know when we're running short on time.
Hi, this is Norma.
Norma, jumping right in there.
My question is, I want some clarification. Based on the discussion I've heard today, it sounds like that the requirement is not necessarily that our proposals hook to a systems change grant, but hook to systems change in general as far as infrastructure. Am I correct?
Yeah, I would say, you know, it doesn't have to be a part of a system change grant, but I would say that you need to know what grants those are, what your whole overall long-term care environment is, and to demonstrate how what you're doing works in consort with the ideas that the other agencies may have put forth in their system change grants.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Okay, next question, please.
I have a question.
Who is this?
Penny Hillman from Mississippi.
Okay, try and speak up if you can.
Okay, our state is really getting into the system change. I'm with Mental Health, and we're partnering with the agency, the aging division in human services. If we had a better chance in getting our proposal funded, if we match even more than is required, because I think we can probably do that with the direct services we plan to provide through both of the agencies.
No. This is Lori.
Okay.
A couple of, I'd expand a little more on that. The only thing, or maybe Linda, the only thing we look at is, did you meet the match requirement? If you go above the match requirement, actually sometimes I feel concerned, because the thing that happens, if you commit to a match amount, say you match at double the amount, you are now beholden to the federal government for that full amount. You can't turn around to change your mind. You can't say, oh, you know, we gave you too much, we only need to do this much. You're stuck with that. And with the fiscal environments that states are in, and just in general kind of budgeting, I would not encourage it, and you will not get extra points for it or anything. And you can certainly put more money into it, but I would not identify it as match. I would leave that money more open if your state needed it, because you don't really want to be beholden to us for any more than you need to be.
I understand. Thank you.
But as Linda just said, once you do it, that's it.
Right. You'll rely before that.
This is Nancy Karakan in Juneau, Alaska.
Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Nancy.
My question is on the 50% direct service, is that in each year or over the course of the 3 years? Because if, let's say you wanted to do 80% infrastructure development the first year and then, you know, or whatever, and then the next year you wanted to do more direct service, could you work it that way?
Yes, maybe, no. That's one of my favorite answers.
Let's say that you really, we have a lot of rural areas that are very difficult to serve, and I, you know, we're looking at this and thinking it's going to take a lot of infrastructure development to even bring the services into those areas. So that's why we thought in the first year of the grant we might need to do more of that, and then the next 2 years be able to do more of the direct service.
Well, I'll give my view, and then Linda can probably correct me or whatever. What I totally understand what you're saying, because historically, all of our demo projects have a slow first year. The startup, the infrastructure, getting the partners on board, you know, getting into the communities, that's the norm. Nonetheless, when the reviewers look at the proposals, they'll be looking for that direct service component in the first year. But now Linda's making faces at me. When you allocate, obligate the money for the direct service, if it doesn't get done in the first year, you'll have money left over that you'll be able to carry over into the second year after you request the carryover, and you'll be able to do those direct services perhaps intended for the first year that didn't quite get started in the second year. But you will want to, you do have to show in your budget a plan for direct services in the first year. Is that okay, Linda?
Mm-hmm, that's it.
I'm good. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so we should still show a plan for 50% direct service in the first year?
Yes, but remember, I think this new, the slight change in the requirement could help you a great deal. Not so much in the first year, but maybe more in the second and third year. But in the past, if you had a $300,000 grant and you matched at $100,000, we expected $200,000 to go to direct service. Under this year's program announcement, if you have a $300,000 grant with a $100,000 match, we're expecting $150,000 to go to direct service, which is going to leave you $250,000 for your infrastructure work.
I see. Okay.
So that's going to give you, you know, $50,000 extra, based on my example, in that first year.
Okay.
And if you would like to discuss this in more detail, I'm happy to do that.
Thanks. And was that Lori or?
This is Lori with Linda backing me up.
Okay, thanks.
Next question.
This is Lynn from Washington. I have sort of a two-part question. One is, we're looking at more of an sort of infrastructure building, sort of the service building component within our family caregiver support program. One of the issues that we will run up against, as we did when we did our last grant back in the early days, was that the way we would decide, because of the limited funding available, is that we would be eliminating on a small basis. We would be doing the demonstration probably in two areas of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to know going in, and we've had partners at the state table as we have been working on planning this, but we're not going to know exactly where the site is until after we put it out for RFP if we find out we get the grant.
We've had states do that.
Okay.
You want to be clear in your proposal what your plan is, what your goals are, what your outcomes are going to be, and be clear that it's pending a request for proposal that will be put out by the state. You know, this is what you're going to be advertising in your RFP, so to speak. for this reason and for this goal.
So as long as we're clear about how we're putting the components you want to see in the ultimate project into our RFP plan, which we should include in the in this grant proposal, we should include those within the grant, is what you're saying.
Right. I mean, you don't have to go into great length about the RFP, but we have had other states where it's the exact same situation. They you can't put out an RFP until you get funding.
Right.
So how can I know where I'm who I'm going to be contacting with because I haven't put out the RFP?
Right.
And we understand that you want to be clear how what your vision is and how you're going to carry that out.
Okay, and that leads to the second part of the question, which is what we have decided, because we can't exactly say where this is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I want to target a low-income population, leaving it open for areas in the local arena to determine if they have a particular population that might also be low-income, such as ethnic or rural. They may be that. But that what we really want to focus, because we're doing more of an infrastructure thing, we're developing a new service component,
mm-hmm.
which will, of course, only be in two areas to start with, but then could be expanded statewide because we'll be putting it into rule for that family caregiver program. So I guess what I'm asking is, as I read through this description, in some points it talks about low income as the target population, but in other areas it seems to stress the limited English speaking or ethnic minorities. So I guess I'm a little bit, because we're uncertain where it's going to be, to target the low income population as an underserved population, or does it have to be also ethnic minority or limited English speaking?
It's traditionally underserved population. And help me again, Linda. So glad she's here. If in your state, your communities, wherever, there is a low-income group, maybe, you know, we all know there's sort of that faulted, cracked group. They're low-income, they're not poverty line, but they are traditionally underserved, in my opinion. And certainly, if that's the group you're targeting, I would be clear as to why this group needs to be targeted in your state or community. I mean, you have a rationale behind this decision,
mm-hmm.
and express it in your proposal. And, you know, if that's, because that's part of what the demo program is for, is trying to help states reach into communities that aren't necessarily getting services. So I think that could be...
Diane, would you like to add anything to that,
Sean? I would just add that, you know, people can be underserved for a whole bunch of reasons, and maybe Lori can check on this, but an analogous answer could be that, you know, in the Older Americans Act under Title III, it says people most in need, and that could be for a bunch of different reasons. So people could be rural, people could be minority, they could have cultural issues. There's a whole array of reasons. That's it.
Next question, please.
Can I just add one thing?
Sure, Lori.
Linda was just saying to me, you know, you just add your justification, you can give examples of, you know, typical communities look like this,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of that demographic information. You've only got 20 pages, so you don't need to go on and on, but I really don't have a concern, but you want to make it clear to the reviewers that...
So it can be any direction.
So that you've addressed it, you know, on sort of a holistic level.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now the next question, please.
This is Nancy and Juno again. I'm wondering, under the direct services, is there anything other than respite care, is there any other direct service that can be provided to the family caregivers? For instance, dementia training for family caregivers or other, like, supportive counseling or whatever to family caregivers. Would any of that qualify as direct service?
My favorite answer. Yes, maybe no.
No.
It was brought up last week, and it's true that this program has traditionally targeted the person with Alzheimer's, but many programs are now incorporating the caregiver more into their services. So, for example, support counseling.
I think that's a good example that I can easily answer because we have some states doing it. If you're offering supportive counseling to a caregiver whose family member has Alzheimer's disease, and if that caregiver can attend those counseling sessions free of, if you'll excuse the term, burden of being a caregiver, meaning that someone is with the family member, that they can go and they can fully attend to that time for them, then I consider that other respite.
Oh, okay.
Because if the caregiver had to scramble to find someone to stay with, you know, her husband, and then struggle to get there and is always looking at their watch or whatever because they're rushed, and that's not a break. But if this allows this person a break and can, you know, and in the ultimate long run, makes them, if you will, a better, that sounds mean, but I hope you know what I mean, you know, feel more confident in their caregiving abilities and skills, then certainly you've provided a direct service to that caregiver. This is one of those questions where I always say it's really case by case. The program's flexibility allows for these kind of discussions, but if you have ideas that fall into some of those categories, I would encourage you to give me a call and we can just sort of talk them through so that before you put it in your proposal, you'll know if it would fit into that category. Unless you feel very confident, that's fine. But I have given that example that I just gave to the grant reviewers to help them understand. But the key is that the caregiver needs to be able to be fully attendant at whatever it is you're offering them.
So even if it was like a training?
Yeah, I mean, we've had some states that have done caregiver trainings where they learn more, like how to deal with problem behaviors,
right,
et cetera, and those are great and very helpful, without a doubt, but the caregiver needs to be able to be fully engaged in that activity without having to be in their role of caregiver during that time, and then I think, you know, as a rule of thumb, but again, caveat, I really prefer to discuss it, you know, instance by instance, because this is sort of some of the gray area. Rule of thumb is it could probably count as other respite.
Oh, okay. And how do we contact you?
My direct phone number is 202-357-3452, or my email address is Lori, L-O-R-I, dot Stahlbaum, S-T-A-L-B, like boy, A-U-M, like Mary, at AOA, dot HHS, dot G-O-V.
Thank you.
I look forward to talking with anyone about anything, anytime.
Do we have another question?
Are we all happy?
Oh, this is Nancy again. I'm full of questions.
Okay.
How many, I don't know if you can answer this, but how many states have never been funded?
One.
Okay, so we don't have a lot of...
Not counting the, you know, Mariana Islands and places like that. You know, continental U.S. states. One.
Final call for questions. Anything from the floor?
Oh.
Okay, well, you can always, I'll talk about the contact information for Diane and Lori. But, you know, from here on out, like I've said a couple of times, this entire teleconference will be on AOA's website and available to you.
Probably within a couple of days.
Mm-hmm. Any questions you may have about the program announcement, its requirements, or your proposal should be directed to Lori, and she just gave you her contact information. Any other technical assistance questions you might have, evidence-based Committee's research, systems change, sustainability should be directed to Diane, who serves as a very good sounding board for your ideas. So feel free to reach her. Her direct number is 202-393-7737, extension 228, or you can reach her at her email address, which is diane.bronstein@alz.org, diane.bronstein@alz.org. I think that is it for all of us, unless...
Hi, it's Lori again. Chris?
Yes, please.
Can I just say one more thing?
Of course.
Which I think you were probably just going to say, but you know, I'm quick on the tongue. I just want to say thank you, everybody, for coming into the conference call, and do want to stress that, you know, Diane or I are available, and actually Linda as well, but if you have any questions that might be specific to the grant things, feel free to give me a call, and if I think it's more on Linda's head, I'll make sure it gets dumped right there to her. And but thank you very much, and please, anything big, small, or in the middle, don't hesitate to contact us anytime. I look forward to getting your proposals. Have a great day, everybody.
And on behalf of myself and Diane and the rest of us at AOA's National Resource Center, I'm Chris, and we're done for the day.
Take care, everyone.
Take care, everyone. Have a good day.
Thanks for providing the opportunity.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks.